There's an awful lot to do, and it's complicated, and it's challenging, and it's exciting, and it's moving, and it's intellectually and emotionally challenging. But by God, is it meaningful?
Hello and welcome. This is Queer Recollections. It's a podcast where we're exploring and rethinking queer British history. In this episode, I speak to Joe Galliano. He is the CEO and co-founder of Queer Britain, a charity set up to establish the first national LGBTQ museum. The museum hasn't been built yet, so they're in the planning stage, but when it's complete, it will be the largest purpose-built queer museum in the world, which brings with it a lot of exciting possibilities to tell queer stories and queer history. So I thought this would be a really good time to find out from Joe about his hopes and plans for the museum.
Politically, with a little p, what I think is really important is that we create an institution that is big enough and flexible enough to be able to really hold in all of the sort of wide variety of stories that we can tell. And we want to make sure the signal that we're giving out is that actually LGBTQ plus people's stories are important and they deserve to be cherished and held up in a prestigious way.
Is that the reason you decided to set it up, or were there other factors involved as well?
Well, it's that, but it's also just that the it doesn't exist, and there isn't a platform which really, really demonstrates how important these stories are. And if you think about what the other museums can do, they can only really sort of touch on our stories in a thorough way from time to time, and there's so many stories to tell that we really want to fill in that missing gap of British history.
What's the reception been like? Have you received any resistance to setting it up at all?
No, actually, do you know, so far not. I think one of the things I hear most often is people go, well, hang on, not this doesn't exist. You mean this doesn't exist? Really? What's been wonderful is the amount of kind of like people who have gathered around telling us how much they want this to happen. And one of the things that I've found really remarkably moving, actually, is I don't think I'd really accounted for how much emotional investment such a huge amount of people have in this happening. And it's very touching, but it also, you know, on a personal level, gives me a great feeling of responsibility of making sure that we look after those feelings.
Do you have an emotional investment as well?
Oh God, yeah. No, I was, you know, as a somebody born in 1971, so growing up through the 80s, personally aware of the damage that it does to not see yourself reflected meaningfully in the culture. You know, I want to make sure that we're a part of making sure that that never happens again. You know, and also just in terms of the sort of the other emotional piece, for me personally, just the ability to be involved in something which just has such a huge amount of meaning, both for myself and for other people, just makes it just, you know, it's a joy.
A joy and a pressure, it sounds like.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, joy and a pressure, but you know, which, you know, I embrace both of those with pleasure.
I'm not sure how far you're involved in this aspect of it, but I was wondering how you imagine the physical space of the museum itself, both in terms of how it looks, but also how it feels as well.
Well, we're designing within the strategy for what we're working to design is a great element of plasticity. So yeah, we talk about some permanent exhibition space within the main museum hub, But we're also talking about very flexible, rolling exhibition space, because the whole point is that there's so many different sets of communities and so many different stories to be told, that actually to create a space that you can hold those stories in, and we can say, right, who is our guest curator at this moment? Okay, Will, what's the story you want to tell in this space? How are you going to tell it? How are we going to use digital? How are we going to use more traditional things? How are we going to bring different community groups in to tell this story, this particular set of stories? So something very flexible. And I think that plasticity really will be built into it. And the other thing is that we'll always be talking about doing pop-up exhibitions around the country. So we have we talk about the main hub, which is the beacon that the whole world can see, and then pop-ups around the country, so we can go out into communities and tell stories in a more sort of nimble way as well.
I guess when I think of queer history, sort of two issues come to mind. The first is that the majority of it perhaps has been lost forever. And the second is that a lot of this history is really depressing. You know, it's a history of repression, violence and misery. And on both those counts, how do you sort of account for this? Account for the lost history, but also the very sad and depressing history without it being, the museum itself being quite a depressing place to visit?
Well, first of all, doesn't the fact that you feel like that tell you about what's missing? Doesn't it tell you about who's controlled the narratives? Doesn't it tell you, actually, you've been hard done by? Because, you know, it's a thread. The difficult times, yes, they're important, but it's a thread in a tapestry that's much, much richer and much, much broader. You know, so, like, for example, one of the first people we spoke to was a woman in her 90s who had been a foster and adopted mother for all her adult life, and had, you know, over 100 kids, or over 100 people out there who still call her mum, and lives that she's rescued, and, you know, nothing to do with being with those lives being LGBTQ+, but her and her partner having made that huge, massively positive impact in the world. And that's not a story of misery. That's a story of joy. That's a story of how people have lived their lives, and how people have put their shoulder to the wheel, and what our place has been in developing society. You know, you're talking about, you know, some of the greatest art that's ever been developed. You're talking about, you know, how have LGBTQ+ people been involved in creation of infrastructure, you know, in science and technology, all of these things. It's a much, much broader, much more exciting palette than we're often led to believe.
Do you imagine it being a place mainly for queer people themselves or non-queer people?
That's a really, really essential question, actually, Will. The image I keep coming back to is the young woman who's just come out to her mum, and it's somewhere for them both to go to together, so that they can both feel like they're part of this really vibrant, exciting sets of communities. Both of them come away feeling like they belong. I mean, if you look at also, typically, if you look at other LGBTQ+ or queer exhibitions, certainly in some of the mainstream institutions. So if you look at the audience figures, they tend to be split sort of 50-50 people who identify with LGBTQ+ people and people who don't. And I think we're really, really missing something if we're just talking to ourselves. Kind of pointless, actually, if we're just talking to ourselves. I think, you know, we need to, the whole point is that this is about, like, if you don't know, if you're interested in history and you don't know your queer history, then you don't know history.
I guess on that point, you know, there's clearly, we don't have full equality certainly in terms of hearts and minds, and also there's, you know, a lot of issues of trans rights at the moment, and the situation elsewhere in the world is dire in some cases. You know, in this context, do you think the museum has a political purpose?
Yeah, I think with a again with a small p, I think museums now have to have that sort of element of wanting to see cultural change. I mean, I would say that the way that I think of it is, I mean, you look back to understand who you are now, mm-hmm. and when you understand who you are now, then you can use that as a sort of way of. And sort of imagining a best of all possible futures of how do we all stand together to imagine where we want to be? How do we create the world that we want to live in? And that's, I think that's, you know, ever more important for museums. Mm. But I'd say, I'd go as far as to say that's, as well as preserving the past and educating about it, I would say that's one of the sort of central reasons for museums to exist.
Mm. Is there a worry that the museum's going to take the hook off other museums to cover queer subjects in depth?
No, well, I think it's something that has to be approached with sensitivity. But I think what it actually does is it would work to demonstrate why all of these other institutions should be looking at their own collections and teasing out the queer stories within them.
Mm.
And in terms of being able to create a, you know, a real set of expertise that can support within the sector, that can support that within the sector. I think this is one of the reasons why I think that what we are doing is so important, why we need a national LGBTQ plus museum, because if we can establish that space, we can support that work in other institutions, particularly with the sort of partnership work and provision of expertise. But we can also embed that within the culture and within the sector. Well, do you have a view on that?
Well, I don't think it necessarily does take other museums off the hook. I guess I agree with you in the sense that a lot of the stuff around people trying to queer museums is led by individuals and often volunteers as well. And so I guess there's that worry if it's not, you know, culturally embedded, if there aren't paid positions. And paid jobs within these museums and dedicated sort of structures, committees, et cetera, then it can really easily all melt away. And especially, and maybe, you know, if you're a museum director, you kind of see a queer museum doing a lot of the things that you might have been able to do in your museum space. There's kind of less motivation to push ahead and do those things.
Yeah, I think that there's more, and I think there's potential for that to be true, but there is also really strong potential for partnership work.
Yeah.
Actually will mean that it'll lift all of that stuff up in both institutions. And you know, obviously you have to demonstrate that this stuff works.
Mm.
And I think that, you know, you look back at say the a really important moment with the Queer British Art Exhibition today at Tate, Britain. And I think that really represented a really important moment, which really showed commercially for those institutions how important some of this stuff is.
Mm. I'm wondering as well that, you know, obviously we've got this sort of alphabet soup that's ever expanding for good reasons. But I'm wondering how you plan to represent all the various intersections and segments of our community in the museum.
I think it's about creating the space to help people tell their own stories.
Mm.
But offering that space for people to tell their stories rather than trying to be too canonical.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not about saying this is one, here is the story, this is the LGBTQ plus story. It's about going, here is the space that these stories can be told.
Mm.
It's also about making sure that we bring in an endless series of guest curators.
Yeah.
So it's kind of not for me to say what those stories should be. What is our responsibility will be about inviting people into that space and saying, right, okay, so Will, you want to be the guest curator for this period. What are you going to do with the space? Here's the space, here's the resource, here's how we do it. Or not rather, here's how we do it, but how do we do it? People have to tell their own stories. People have to own their own stories.
Where are you in this whole process at the moment? Just to sort of like anchor ourselves in it. I have a rough idea myself, but it'd be great if you could explain.
So in terms of the development?
Yeah, in terms of the development, exactly.
Yeah. So we are about a year and a half into having become a charity. Turns out that it's quite complex and quite complex and expensive launching a museum. Who knew? Who knew? And we're taking a very sort of deliberate and strategic approach.
I mean, in terms of the time scale, how's that looking? And has the current situation put a brake on it?
We were the other thing that we were just about to do as this pandemic kicked off. We were about to, the board have just given a enthusiastic sign off on identifying a meanwhile space. Mm-hmm. That was going to be our next thing that we were going to be doing this summer. Yeah, clearly that ain't going to happen this summer, but that will be about identifying the space, some space which is which we can, you know, is going to be cheap. Mm-hmm. That we can experiment with modes of exhibiting, modes of exhibitions rather. We can bring community and business partners into to sort of see what we're doing, bring community groups in and so forth. I think that's going to happen next year now. I think we're really looking at a push. We're looking at a 5-year window.
Did you think this would be possible at the beginning? When you maybe first came up with the idea or the thought first crossed your mind,
yeah.
Did you think it was possible?
Yeah, I think that in all circumstances, museums and similar sort of institutions have been launched. And so I see no reason why, if it can be done, if it has been done, I see no reason why it can't be done. It can't be done if you don't approach it strategically and carefully and deliberately. Just for example, running a building without any of the other sort of infrastructure in place, I think is a recipe for it not happening. And so actually building, so carefully building up all of the stuff that doesn't seem quite so sexy but is really important, is vital.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the reason I asked that question was because it's not really been done before, is it? Firstly, it's difficult just in the sense that it's a, you know, big national museum, but also it's a queer museum as well, and nothing on its scale has been attempted yet, which is really exciting.
Yeah, but you know what? There's museums for all sorts of things all around the world that aren't as important as this as a subject matter. And you know, if you can launch museums about pencils. we can launch a museum that really has that emotional core to it. It's the eye that, a lot of the time, it's the eye that you're bringing to it. So it's that queer perspective as much as anything, potentially. Is that true? Do you think, is that fair? Do you think?
I think absolutely. But I guess that kind of jars with the, you know, traditional way of viewing objects or approaching history in kind of that neutral, assumed academic way. But I think that personal perspective is crucial, and that personal connection to a particular object or piece of history or story.
Because it becomes, doesn't it? It becomes more of a conversation with.
Yeah.
It becomes more of a conversation rather than a, and I'll come back to this again, rather than being canonical, rather than being saying this is what happened, this is what this means. And actually, yeah. I think you come back, don't you, to that whole point about what does the viewer, what do we bring to it as well? I mean, obviously, that's not the only thing, but, and I guess as well, you talked about the decolonization debate that's going on at the moment. And, you know, what is that about other than asking us to shift perspective as to what does this thing mean, and who has told us what this thing means. You know, who's controlled those stories? And let's face it, we know that we know, don't we, that history has been written by the winners. I mean, that's a cliche if ever there was one. But as my mother would say, it's a cliche. Cliches are cliches because they're true.
I guess that's why it's so difficult trying to even conceptualize what this museum might look like, because there's a lot of contested points
in terms of.
In terms of the history itself, and also how how you might present it, you know, people might have different opinions on even maybe the language to use. The word queer itself is obviously like problematic for some people, for example.
Yes, yeah. I mean, that's a whole fascinating area for discussion in and of itself.
Because you think about the last 50 years, and this isn't just true of queer history as well, but you know, perhaps more's happened in the last 50 years, or there's been more dramatic changes in the last 50 years than there have in the last 200, 300 years.
Yeah, and it's also why I think we need to be very careful that we preserve and keep pushing forwards. We don't take our foot off the pedal in terms of embedding LGBTQ plus people visibly at the heart of society, because you know, when change happens very quickly, it can also roll back very quickly. And you know, my fear is that we, you know, if we stand on a sort of a thin meniscus of history, it's very easy for that to be punctured. And you know, I think we all have to do what we can to make sure that doesn't happen.
I agree.
And this is partly. Partly, this is hopefully my part in contributing to that embedding.
Well, that's kind of how I see this stage, if you like, of our liberation carrying on. It's trying to embed these changes in permanent institutions, and the Queer Museum's one example. The community centre, I know that some people are trying to set up, is another example, maybe. The queer studies MA, even that there is at Goldsmiths. I'm sure there's loads of other community examples as well. I just don't know about. So many places, brick and mortar spaces, have closed down in the last 10-15 years, and so it kind of leaves us wondering, you know, like if all these, you know, it'd be really easy for all these places to close, and then what?
Well, I mean, and this is it. I mean, I've seen this change, you know, I've seen this change in my lifetime, and I've seen it accelerating. And the thing is that we, you know, for all of the apps and for all of the things that digital can bring us, we're social creatures. And, you know, we create, I mean, this is why the lockdown's been so difficult, isn't it, for so many people, is that, you know, we have a fundamental need to leave our homes and go out into the world and mix with other people. And you know, that's how we best socialize. That's how we best share our ideas. It's how we best meet people that might bring unexpected collisions into our lives in ways that result in unexpected outcomes. Very hard to do that if you're just glued into an app, or you're just glued into the screen. And also, we need places that aren't just focused around alcohol as well, and clubs, because you know, as well as the fact that it's not necessary, I mean, they are very, very important spaces, but to have your whole identity built around alcohol environments, quite damaging in some ways for some people. And if we also look at those spaces, how they've, you know, they've not always been very welcoming for, say, people who are trans, or maybe people of colour, or people with disabilities. Mm-hmm. And actually, we've got the potential to create some spaces that are much more embracing, are exciting in different kinds of ways, meaningful in different kinds of ways, and that allow us to mix in different kind of ways, and be seen in different kind of ways, and to understand ourselves in different kinds of ways. And that's I think that's probably one of the things that really gets me out of bed and working on this every day.
Obviously, when you think about representation in the community itself, it's mostly gay men who tend to be dominant. And even when you say the word gay, that's the kind of image that comes to most people's minds. How do you try and decenter that in the museum and make it more sort of genuinely inclusive and representative?
We're not approaching this in a sort of hand-wringing way. What we're doing is we're not doing that thing that you get like a lot of companies and they go, "Oh, diversity is very difficult." And it's like, actually, inclusion's exciting because it means that we're going to be, we want people who are not, don't look like us. We don't want people who don't think like us. And at the moment, we're in the middle of a conscious inclusion strategy. So we are starting off having having sectional conversations that are with small groups of people who are selected based on identities. So first group discussion that we had was a group of people of color. We just before lockdown we were having a, we had a trans group meet together. We're working currently on talking to a disability group, assembling a disability group. The question that we're asking is, what would amazing look like? What would make you want to be part of this? What would make this make you want to bring your friends along? What would make you want to be a part of the family that we're working to build? Now, although we're in listening mode at the moment, what I think will probably happen is that from those initial conversations, we'll then bring those groups back together intersectionally so that we'll have the same sort of conversation again, but so that everybody can hear everybody else. And I imagine, although, like I say, we're in listening mode, so I'm not entirely sure that this is how it'll end up, but I imagine that we'll probably develop a an inclusion council from that in order to really just have as a filter, just go, who's, have we got, is everybody's voice here? Are we missing anybody? Who's not being heard? Yeah, something we're working through.
It sounds complicated.
Yeah, it's brilliant, brilliantly complicated
Yeah.
in terms of making sure everybody's voice is.
Yeah, I guess it's yeah, in terms of making sure everyone's included.
It's vital though.
Yeah.
It's vital. And also, do you know what? If we don't do it, I'm not interested for myself. If we can't build this with everyone, then we're not building this for anyone. I can't think of anything I would less like to go to than a white, gay, cisgendered men's museum. I think it's much, much more interesting if we can actually genuinely create a community that's all linked arms. And the thing that I'm enjoying actually from these conversations actually is that so far really what we're hearing is people are saying pretty much the same things. People want the same things. They want to be able to be in control of their own stories. They want to be in control of their own of the language that they're talked about. They want to be made to feel like they're celebrated. They want to be heard. And it's the same thing that any of us want.
I guess it's in some ways a huge opportunity, because a lot of museums, cultural spaces, et cetera, are kind of approaching diversity, several hundred years sometimes into their founding, in which case at which time the inequalities are really well set in. And the process of trying to diversify the museum is one of trying to, overcome these structures that are already built. But perhaps
Exactly,
in
yeah.
the queer museum, there's a chance to sort of build it with this function from the ground up.
Yeah, which is exactly what we're trying to do. But I mean, and it's, you know, yes, you can understand that it's when you inherit structures and power structures as well, that it's a complicated thing to unpick. But unpick it, it must be done. Mm. It must be done.
That's really exciting. I don't envy you, though.
There's an awful lot. I think of it as like, it's not so much spinning plates as spinning buckets. Yeah. There's an awful lot to do, and it's complicated, and it's challenging, and it's exciting, and it's moving, and it's intellectually and emotionally challenging. But by God, is it meaningful? I've genuinely lost track of how many people. Actually, Will, this is the thing that I was surprised by. But this is the thing that took me by surprise, was that, you know, right from the start, when I started talking to people about this idea, the amount of times I'll be halfway through describing what it is I think we should be working towards, and I can't tell you how many people you look at somebody and you realize that they're welling up. Mm. And it always catches me out. And it's always the thing that makes me go, A, you're on the right track. And B, yeah, we have to carry this responsibility responsibly. And it makes me realize that it's worth it.
So that was Joe Galliano speaking about his plans for a queer British museum. There's been a lot of activity in the last few years trying to document queer history and heritage, and there's so many incredible individuals doing this. But there isn't yet a single dedicated museum space to cover the breadth and diversity of queer British history and life. So it's an incredibly exciting time, and do keep up to date with what Queer Britain are doing. Their website is queerbritain.org.uk, and you can follow them on social media as well. Otherwise, this has been Queer Recollections. I'm Will, and thank you so much for listening.